Well, yeah. When you perceive emptiness intellectually, it's through a dunshi.
So you can access that place with that will from then on.
No.
No. I mean, like, what's in the path of the visual situation? You, when you come out of it and all that,
yeah.
And you live in day to day,
yeah.
You have the distinction.
Oh,
you're
you
still
can.
Still continuing your meditation.
Yeah, but you don't. But you don't necessarily have that experience again very soon. It's close. But most of your perceptions of emptiness, even on the path of habituation, are intellectual again. Okay. No, and that's very useful in the case of the screaming boss. You can't go into deep meditation while your boss is screaming. He won't sign the paycheck next week. Michael Roach went cataleptic during the while I was screaming at him, you know. You know. Yeah.
Yeah.
I, yeah.
He's just occurring
yeah.
Like everything else is just occurring.
Yeah.
And you have that the gap in between the projection of what's onto what's occurring that allows the detachment.
Yeah. You're aware that he's not what he seems to you. You know that you're wrong. At least you know you're wrong. You're still wrong, but at least you know it. Okay. That's gyumatabo. That means what? That's the illusion. Yeah. Okay. Let's meditate for like 5 minutes. Okay. I think just meditate. Have some yirang. Have some rejoice. You know, we are flirting with the destruction of your mental afflictions. You know, it's a very cool place to be flirting. You know, we are dancing around the subject, the only subject that can remove your mental afflictions forever and make you truly contented forever. And that would be really nice, you know. This whole thing of going through the day, swinging between liking people and disliking people, and not in a major way, but just this continual struggle of going down the street with like and dislike grabbing at you and beating you up as you walk down the street, you know, it'll be over. And your mind will be in a place where you just happy all the time. So be happy right now. I mean, rejoice that we are flirting with the weapon for the destruction of the mental affliction, you know. And it's very rare to have the opportunity, and it's rare that a group of people would sit in one place and talk about these things. Extremely rare, especially in an accurate way. So rejoice, just be happy for a while. It enhances the merit immensely. Okay. About things that don't really matter much. Okay. Going to places that you don't really need to go, seeing things you don't really need to see. Cut it down. You won't be able to see emptiness if you don't cut it down. If you don't cut out those 4 or 5 hours of BS in your life per day, you'll never see emptiness. You don't have time. You won't have time. You just won't have time. It takes a couple hours a day to work on it. Are magazines evil? You know, is TV bad? You know, are movies destroy your peace of mind? Well, they do, but that's another point. I'm going to one tomorrow. But anyway, it's not the point. You don't have time for both. I mean, you can't serve both masters. Make up your mind. You know, you cannot live in both of those worlds. You can't have both. You can't have samsara and get rid of it too. You know, you got to make a decision, and it's going to take time. You're going to have to devote a lot of your time to it. You must find a good teacher, and you must serve that teacher. You got to make up your mind in that sense about renunciation. Renunciation. Cut down on your worldly activities. You don't need to read that stuff. You can't even tell me what was in the paper that you read a week ago, you know, or yesterday, you know. What's the point, you know? Who cares what's on the news, you know? You know what it's going to be. Suffering. You know, who's killing who? What's going wrong, you know? Because it has to be like that. So just stop it. Cut down those other things. You know, people who say they don't have time to practice Dharma. It's not true. Something's going on. If your job requires you to overwork to the point of being tired, that you can't meditate properly, and it requires you to work overtime, and does not allow you time to do retreats, then find another job. Take a job that pays less. And don't wait. You know, you don't have time. You don't know when you're going to die. You know, so act, do it now. Don't have any doubt about it. Just make up your mind. Don't doubt what we talked about tonight. Don't doubt that it's possible. You can do it. You will do it. Don't kid yourself that anything else is worth anything. This is the only thing that's worth anything. What we talked about tonight is the reason to have a human life. Now, this is the goal. You can do it, but you have to commit yourself something. You have to make up your mind. You can't sit on the fence. If you really want it, then cut down your worldly activities and study this sutra deeply for a long time. Serve a spiritual friend, and you'll do it. And there's nothing else to do. Last thing, last realization that you get that day, and then I'll stop. And then I'd like to meditate for a few minutes, because this is the holiest subject we can talk about. What we just spoke about is the holiest 2 hours you ever spend in your life, probably, for sure. You've just collected that merit that doesn't have measure. We have just done some great deed. We are all chosen people tonight. You know? The day that you become enlightened, they will not call you Mike anymore. That's the last realization. Okay? The day that you become Buddha, they will not call you Mike anymore. Okay? Or Jay, or Elizabeth, or Tusney, or Amy, or they won't call you that anymore. Okay, meditate for a while. Okay. Tonight is just a chance to talk about what we talked about. I'd like first to just do a brief review of what we talked about. And then make some notes to yourself. You know, in the monastery we had this debating custom, and the way it goes is that in the early morning you memorize some text, and then in the mid-afternoon, I mean the mid-morning, you might go to debate ground, but normally in the mid-morning you have a class, and the teacher explains what you've been memorizing. Then you have a big lunch. Then you sneak a nap, and everybody pretends that nobody knows. And then in the afternoon you have another class. You eat dinner, you take a rest, and then you hear what's called a kanga. Ka means space, sky, and na means drum. And kanga means a gong. It's kept at the top of the main temple, and somebody goes up and bangs on the gong. And the minute you hear the gong, your heart starts to beat, you know, and you start to get adrenaline, because that means you have to start thinking about coming to debate ground. And you hear it dong, and you're kind of hoping that they'll cancel it tonight for some reason, you know, like, you see if there's any rain coming, or maybe the abbot's having a meeting or something. But when you hear the first bong, you know you have to go to debate ground. So then you start cramming really fast. And then they hit it another time, and then they hit it another time, and it gets faster and faster. It's like dung, 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 dung. And then you, when it reaches its crescendo, you've got to be on your way or else you get in trouble. And you have to enter the gate, you know, by the time they finish the last dong. And then you sit down and do prayer. And you feel real naked, because all you can take is your rosary and your cushion. And you sit on the stones. It's just flagstones, and you just sit there, and it's open air, and it's nice. And you start just before dark, say. And then it starts to get dark, and you do some prayers. Those prayers are praying that for inspiration during the debate, and they're also praying that you don't have any new mental afflictions because of the debate. You know, like, I hope I beat him, or, you know, get mad from being beat, or stuff like that. So actually, twice a week, they actually won't debate. They'll pray the whole time for two hours or 3 hours, just that they don't have bad thoughts during the debate. And then you break up into one-on-one, and that can be anybody. You know, you walk around the debate ground, and it's like a high school dance, you know, and you're like, And if there's somebody you kind of want to connect with, you like, you know, like across the cart yard. If there's somebody who's really good and you want to avoid the guy, you know, you keep your eyes down, and then you do one-on-one, and that can be with anybody in any class. So it could be a junior debating a senior, or an eighth grader debating a senior, or you know, and that's really good because you get to hear. If it's somebody older than you, you get to hear what you haven't reached yet, and you start to get a taste for it. And if it's somebody much younger than you, you get to review the math you did in the sixth grade, which you forgot already. So it's a really good process. You do one-on-one for a while, maybe an hour and a half. And then the Giku, who's the debate master, he walks around with his fan, his shawl. He drops his shawl, and he goes like this, and you're supposed to run and get into your classes. And then all the seniors debate with all the seniors, and it's like 30 people, and you line up in two lines, and you face each other like a gauntlet. And then nobody wants to be the guy who's getting attacked, who sits in the front, so everybody's like, trying to get back, you know, from the front. And then the class leader will come along and he'll collect everybody's rosary. And you all throw your rosary on him. And he's got this big pile of rosaries and he throws them up in the air. And he closes his eye and he grabs one as it comes down. And then that's the guy who has to defend. And then he takes them all again and he throws them up. And that's the assistant defender. So there's two guys at the head of the column. It looks like a gauntlet. And there's two guys at the front. Then he throws it up again, and that guy has to start the debate. And the reason I brought it up is that after a certain point, after a certain number of years of debating, you find out that if your rosary gets picked last, and you're supposed to start the debate, that the best thing to do is pick something you're not sure about. You know, pick something that didn't quite seem right to you in the class that afternoon. You know, try to pick some. In other words, when you first start debating, you want to avoid those things because you don't understand them, and you're afraid that people will see that you don't understand them. But I think as you get more mature in debating, and less defensive about it, you actually try to go after the points that weren't very clear to you, or seem confusing, or seem contradictory, or you know, you gravitate towards the difficult points. And the ones that didn't quite seem right when the Lama presented it. And then you have a real fruitful debate. And by the end of the debate, you instead of seeing other people as opponents, you see them as helpers in trying to work out this problem together. And then by the end of the night, it's really cool. You've really worked it out in a very cool... Normally, you've worked it out in a very cool way because everybody's putting their brains together. And then sometimes you go back and you read a commentary by Bhutan or something, and it turns out that he figured it out exactly the same way that you and your debate buddies did that night. And it's really cool. So I propose we do something like that. You know, try to bring up all the points that didn't quite sound right, and the points that I was waffling on and stuff like that. And probably I wasn't too clear in my own mind about them. And then we'll work them out. Instead of trying to work on what we know, we'll try to work on what's not too clear, and then maybe I'll be forced to clarify it in my own mind, and maybe we'll all work it out. It's like a debate. I'll go over briefly what we talked about in the last two classes, and then maybe you can keep a list of things that you weren't too satisfied with, okay? And then we should debate those. We should talk about those. Tuesday night's class was about the perfections. And we pointed out that the word perfection is admitted in the scriptures to be something, it's almost a misnomer. If you're practicing the perfections, like you and me trying to practice giving, the perfection of giving, it's anything but a perfection. We're not perfect at it at all. It's not perfect at all. So why do they call it perfection? And then we talked about the two meanings of perfection. One was paro te chinche, which means makes you perfect. And then we talked about paro te chin sin, which means already perfect. Paro te chin sin, already perfect. An already perfect perfection is the kind of perfections that the Buddhas do. Paro te chin che are those six activities which get you to perfection. And then we looked into paro te chin che to see if every kind of action that we ever do is that. So we took the profession of giving, and we talked about doing it, and it came out that it's paro to chin che, it's getting you to perfection, if you're doing it with an understanding of emptiness. And if you're not doing it that way, it's not paro to chin che. Okay? But can you still call it a paro to chin pa? You know, paro to chin pa meaning a plain old paramita. You know, in other words, if you do one of those six activities without an understanding of emptiness, is it still a perfection? Well, is it the perfection of someone who's already perfect? No. Is it a perfection that's directly acting to get you to perfection? No. Is it still, can we still call it a perfection? And the Buddha says, okay, you can call it a perfection. Why? It looks like a perfection. Why? Especially if you're doing it with the wish of reaching enlightenment for the sake of other beings, okay? So if that's in the back of your mind as you do an act of giving, for example, we can call it perfection because then it resembles a real perfection, which is a perfection done with an understanding of the emptiness of the situation, and those get you to paro to chin sin, which is the perfection in the mind of a perfect being, okay? And we talked about the three elements in the situation. You can say the giver, sometimes. Some scriptures leave that one out. You can say the thing that you're giving. You can say the person receiving it. And then most scriptures say the event of giving, the giving itself, the act of giving. So some scriptures leave out the act and add the actor, and most the scriptures that we're using in this for this class, they leave out the actor and put in the act of giving, but it doesn't really matter. Those are obviously all elements in the act of giving, and each one of those is empty, and you have to be perceiving each one of those three spheres, it's called, as being empty as you perform an act of giving. So what does it mean to give, to perform an act of giving with while understanding the emptiness? It means to understand the emptiness of those three elements of the situation. The gift, the recipient, and the whole act of giving itself. And then some scriptures say they replace the act of giving with the person giving it. Doesn't really matter. Okay? Yeah.
Do all the sexes have three in
them? I'd say some have three and some have four in my mind. We'll talk about it. And I'll just go through the whole thing because some people weren't there and I just want to make sure they hear it once. Was there anything else in that class? I don't know. I don't remember. Yeah.
I don't understand how can there be a recipient, say, of an act of meditation or an act of where it's not necessarily a design recipient.
Right. I have a feeling, I can check it, okay? But I have a feeling in that case it would be the meditator, what you're meditating on, and the act of meditation. You know, I have a feeling that it would be that in the act of meditation. Mm-hmm. Perhaps you could add the person that you're meditating on behalf of, you know, which is all sentient beings, but I don't know, that applies to almost all of them. Then you'd get five or four, but I believe it would be those three in the act of meditating. But I'll check. I have this database of like, the guys doing the translation work with me know, we have like 100,000 pages of scriptures on the computer and you can just ask, what are the three spheres in the act of meditation? And so maybe we'll keep a list of things. Can you do that, Clinton? Three spheres in the perfection of meditation, for example. Yeah, okay. We talked about... Was that cosmology? Oh, yeah, the act of giving with an understanding of emptiness was more virtue than filling up... And then we went to Abhidhamma cosmology, where they say there's 1,000 inhabited planets make one first level world system, and then 1,000 of those, which means 1,000,000 planets, makes a second order world system, and then 1,000 of those, which would be 1,000,000,000 planets, makes a third level world system, and that if somebody, it says if some virtuous man or woman, Rikki Puam, was to fill up those planets with precious gemstones and offer that. Later it says offer it to the Buddha, by the way. Later they get more extreme. Do you remember, Clinton, what we talked about today? There's a section later where he gets more extreme than that. He's about the Ganges.
Oh, yeah.
What's he say?
If you had as many
Ganges River as there are particles of water in the Ganges River.
Yeah.
And just all of those particles of water in all of those Ganges rivers.
And had that many planets. That many planets and filled them up with diamonds, basically, and offered it to the Buddha. The virtue that you get from performing an act of giving with an understanding of emptiness is infinitely more than that. Okay? Okay? Is that all in that class? I don't know.
That underlying thing, not being in relationship.
Oh, yeah, that was a tough part. We went over a concept that Shoni Dabo Shib covers, which is if two things have a relationship, they have to. There's two requirements. They have to be separate. What was the other one? And they have to both exist. Do you have a relationship with it? How could you have a relationship with something that doesn't exist? How could you relate to anything that doesn't exist? I mean, like if you say this man and this lady and her husband are having a relationship, and then the husband dies, then the relationship with the death of the husband, there's no more thing called a relationship. If one of them is gone, there can't be a relationship. For them to be interacting, there has to be existence on both halves, on both sides.
But one of the qualities of karma is that the result is similar to the cause, so that's a way of relationship. I mean, you do something and it has to create a result similar to the cause, and that's one way of using that.
Oh, there was a big debate, you know, Shoni Dabo Shib said. I mean, you can debate it, so I'll say... So you're saying that the result, we'll do the better here. You're saying that the result is related. No, I won't. It's easier for me because I win. The result is related to the cause in one sense. And there's four different karmic results, but let's take that one. It's called Yuting Yudhima. So the result is related to the cause because in one sense, for example, when you kill people, that you get killed back. So you have a result of getting killed back many times for one act of killing. So therefore, getting killed a lot of times later is related to the act of killing. So is that true?
Yeah.
Yeah. So those getting killed a lot of times later has a relationship with having killed somebody once.
Yeah.
Right. So in a normal debate in a monastery, you'd say, well, which one of those two classic relationships is it? Is it cause and effect, or is it a relationship of identity? Okay. A relationship of identity, an example is?
Car and Chevrolet.
Car and Chevrolet, okay. Mm-hmm. And remember, that what was the check of a relationship? What was the test of a relationship? If you remove one, the other one's always removed. So, for example, if you had never killed anybody, you would never have to be killed many times. If you removed all cars in the world, Chevrolet would have to go. By the way, that's only a one-way relationship, not a two-way relationship. Petra and the reverse of all that Petra is not, which is important in Buddhist philosophy, are mutually related in an identity. Okay, but anyway, that's a big debate.
I guess in the translation, when they were talking about the sense in which a relationship does exist,
right,
they say you have to admit that it exists in a general way. And I don't understand the significance of using the word general.
General is a great way to get out of problems in debate. Generally, that's true. But anyway, let's go back to that, and we'll get there. So getting killed many times later is related to killing somebody now, right? So getting killed many times has already happened. Or is happening now, I should say. Right?
Getting killed many times has already happened now?
Yeah.
No.
Well, then there's no relationship. Oh, well, when will it happen?
In the future, that doesn't exist.
Let's leave it at in the future. So then the killing once is in the future. They do this in the debate. They say, oh, so I guess killing once is in the future. And then they go like that. Right?
No, they're not.
Huh? So let's say you're just doing it right now, okay? So killing once is in the future.
No.
It's not? Then you'd have to feign, like, astonishment. You know, like, it's not? So you're saying that the getting killed back many times exists in the future.
Right.
But killing once doesn't exist in the future? That what you're trying to tell me? This is called Pelanger, Prasangika. This is Prasangika. It is. A lot of it is bluffing. You're hoping the other guys are bluffing. No, no, no. Are you telling me that they don't exist? That are you telling me that doing the one killing doesn't exist in the future?
Yeah.
Yeah, you say, yeah, that's what I said.
Yeah.
Duh. I said, duh. Duh means you got it right, yeah. So I say, so they don't exist at the same time.
No.
So they don't have a relationship.
No.
So they don't have a cause and effect relationship.
Yes.
So Lende Milua Mayambata. So the laws of karma and effect are not infallible. The law of karma and its consequences is not infallible, I guess. And you say,
no.
Teacher, why did you say that? And then I say, because karma is not related to its consequences. Teacher, good. Yeah. Why do you say that? Because they don't share a relationship. And then you say, why do you say that? And I say, because they don't share in a relationship of identity, and they don't share a relationship of cause and effect, which is the only two ways you can.
They do have
a cause and effect relationship, right?
It's just that they don't.
No, go ahead.
At the same time.
No, all you say is yes and no. Seriously, and we arrive at truth. We arrive at truth as surely as a computer program does. Right. So they do have a cause and effect relationship. Oh, so I guess they both exist. So I guess they both exist.
Why do you say that?
Because you have a relationship, the two things are required. They both exist and they are not the same thing.
Yeah, they both exist.
Good.
No, it's the same.
So the future has come already.
Sure,
that didn't take long.
No.
No, so the consequence and the deed occur at the same time.
Yeah.
So they don't both exist. Don't let him get out of it. Let's squeeze him to the end here. No, in a general sense, you have to admit, says Chani Dakashenu, that they exist. Now, if you examine it closely, they can't. One of them is yet to come and therefore doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
And from the point of view of the future result, one of them has already happened. So they can't be existing at the same time. Strictly speaking. But when you're talking about the law of karma and its consequences, you are taking data, which means a future event and a present event, you are synthesizing it into it. You are focusing on both of them at the same time and synthesizing that and calling it the laws of cause and effect. And in that sense, they both exist. Mm-hmm. They both exist in the present.
Mm-hmm.
Because they are the law of cause and effect. But if you take each one separately, you're going to get in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Something like that? So maybe that's what general means here? Okay. And then I think, I mean, personally, I would show an example of Lincoln's assassination. You know, and by the way, there's a big debate in Buddhist philosophy about whether the future exists or not,
mm-hmm.
and whether the past exists or not. Thus, if the past didn't exist, you wouldn't be here, because your mom wouldn't have ever happened.
Mm-hmm.
But if the past does exist, then the present is getting very crowded because you got the past and the future now. And then, you know, you can go on like that all night. But I think the point is that if you really examine things, you come to these conundrums, to these unsolvable problems. That's an indication of the gotcha. The gotcha is hanging around because the more you examine it, the less you find.
Mm-hmm.
So there's something gotcha about this whole question. we are thinking of things in a way that can never be resolved. You couldn't be seeing Petra's face because you have to see her eyes and her nose and her mouth to see her face. And when you're seeing her eyes and her nose and your mouth, how could you be seeing her face? But how could you see her face without seeing her eyes and her nose and her mouth? And it's a paradox, and that's a sign that we're dealing with a self-existent object. It's an impossibility. In the sutra, he says machipa, machipa. He keeps saying machipa. Machipa means it could never have happened. He said the marks of a Buddha are machi. They couldn't have happened. You see them there, but they couldn't have happened. According to the way you think, they couldn't have happened. That's a clue, okay? That's called Tanyatapa Dakkhin Sarvasena Manye, that we talked about the first night. When you look for the object that got the name without giving it a name, well, you're going to look forever. Because until it gets a name, you can't find it. You can't think of it until you give it a name. Like that. Okay, did you have a... And I don't know why I put that on the homework. I don't know why I got into that. I don't remember why. Maybe, I think he covered it in the sutra at that point or something. I don't remember exactly why it was in that class. It doesn't seem to go with the rest of the stuff. Yeah.
Okay. The word used in the translation is persona.
Yeah.
Persona means the same thing that C.G. Young
employed. No. Not at all. I was trying to, you know, they're using in the sutra all these words for self. They use dak, they use kangsak, they use sok, and there's one more. What's the other one? Sentient. Yeah. Yeah, sentient means mind haver. So you can say sentient being. Sok means life, which ultimately means anything alive. So you can say living being. And then, what's the other one? Kangsak. Kangsak is normally translated as person, but dak, and then dak is more normally translated as self. But I was trying to get, I think I was using person for self and I ran out of words. Mm-hmm. So I was using persona. Gangsat has more of a sense of persona in the sense of identity. Mm-hmm. And I thought that persona was more.
Is it the Latin sense of mind?
No.
No.
Mm-mm.
Okay.
We, in fact, Dr. Koitzer, we spent like 2 hours on this figuring out what the real meaning of Gangsat. What was it? Gang thought, you know. Is that, was that? Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Literal translation of gang thought. It's, you know, person, what we're calling person. Full of, what was it? Full of lower, full of inferior bachas, and therefore falling into samsara. And that's gang thought, which is person in Tibetan and in Sanskrit. We figured out that it wasn't, that it was really that way in Sanskrit also. But I didn't want to bore you with that. Yeah. Yeah.
I have a question about when you talk about the act of giving,
yeah,
instead of like giver and gift, when you talk about an act, our minds think of actions like occurring over time.
Yeah.
And yet they're all empty. And it was all like, it's sort of like you kind of hit it glancingly with the karma, because if it's an act of giving, what is the act part? What is the part that is empty? And if you see the bird and you give him one piece of bread and then another piece of bread, and then another piece of bread, what part is action? And what is action?
It's a good question, and the answer is this. It's the difference between the collection of the parts of a static object and the collection of the parts of an event, a moving event. You know, it's easy to think of the collection of parts of a static object like a person. That's what we called Sokchi last night. A collection of parts, a collection of physical parts. It's easy, you know, the example of the chariot or the car is easy, because it's easy to imagine that the parts are the wheel and the windshield and the top and the bottom and the brakes and that everything together is car. Not exactly, but anyway. But what about moving events? You know, what about an event of giving? When you reach your hand out, they take it, and then they withdraw their hand. And there's, in other words, how do you impute time? How do you impute action? It's on the series of moments. They become the parts of the action. Okay. So instead of taking Petra's eyebrows, eyes, nose, and mouth and calling it Petra's face, you take the person reaching out with their hand, you take the person reaching out with their hands, you take the exchange of the object and the withdrawing of hands, and on those three parts, you say active giving. You synthesize it according to your past karmic seed. You synthesize it in the manner that you are forced to by your own past karmic seeds, and then you call it the act of giving. If your karmic seeds had been different, then that same data would be called stealing, or someone giving something to somebody out of hatred, you know. Or, you know, in other words, two people could have the same data and perceive it as opposite things. And one person would say, oh, that's cool, you know, Jim's giving dinner to somebody or something, and then somebody else would say, oh, look, Jim's trying to poison that guy, you know. The same data, on the same data, according to your own karma, your own past karma. That's why sometimes you enjoy a dinner and sometimes you don't. Yeah.
I might have a related question. I'm having a lot harder time wrapping my mind around the non-existence of myself,
right,
than of objects, because it seems like the projection is projecting.
No. That's true. Yeah. That's true. I mean, what might help is to realize that you're always one microsecond behind. You know, as soon as you're aware of yourself, the self that you're aware of is already gone. It's already in the past. We're like that star where the light of planet Earth always reaches there 20 years after it left the planet. Like, we don't know that the stars that we see at night now are still there, because it took 20 million years for the light to come. I don't know, 20 years for the light to get here. We don't even know that the star that sent the light is still there. And technically, you are the same. You might have died a microsecond ago, but you still see yourself as moving, you know. Let's check.
No. It's part of language, but it's always the way we refer to when we're talking about the non-existence of self, we refer to, in our explanations of it, we talk about I and me.
Yeah. The question in Buddhist philosophy is, who's the driver? You know, who's the driver? And each school has a different answer. The Abhidhamma says, it's the movement of your five parts through time is you. And then by the time you get up to the lower Madhyamika school, they say that ultimately you are your mental awareness. You are the person who hears the thoughts in your mind. And that's who you are, you know. And that's pretty close. I mean, you kind of want to hang on to that one, you know. The person who's listening to the thoughts in my mind is who I am. You know, that's the driver. You know, in the end, that's the real me. And then the next school up, Prasangika says, that's not the way it is. You are the synthesis of the parts of you and the naming of those parts, and that's who you are. Abhidhamma, actually. The second word is Svatantrika. And there's a lot between there that I don't quite remember, okay? But they're, you know, they're less subtle. Yeah.
So if all your perceptions are actually of a past moment?
Well, let's say you're not... Your perceptions are current, but let's say the thoughts that you hear, those are already past. Yeah. Yeah. The thoughts that you're listening to are technically, normally, your mental awarenesses of the microsecond before. And then there's a big debate about whether there's a thing called apperception, meaning, can the listener listen to itself at the moment that it's listening? Are you aware of listening at the moment that you're listening? Because if you are, that means that mind has the power to know itself before it becomes an object. The subject is perceiving the subject before it becomes an object of the moment before. And then there's a huge debate about that. The higher schools say there isn't such a thing as apperception. Yeah. Say again? Oh, I'm talking about, and we're going to talk more about it. There's a huge division in the Buddhist schools between those who understand and can explain pretty much correctly the fact that we are naming that a thing is the sum of its parts, which is dependent origination according to the lower Madhyamika school, and then the next school up, which is Prasangika, which is the highest and the correct school, that says the thing is not the sum of its parts. This is very delicate. This is very subtle. Any object being the sum of its parts is not ultimately the meaning of any object dependent origination. Why? Without anyone around to synthesize that and then name it what it is, it couldn't be in and of itself anything. Therefore, the ultimate meaning of dependent origination is not that things are the sum of their parts. It's that you take the sum of the parts, you synthesize them in the way that your past karma forces you to, which is different for each person, and then you name it something. When I say different for each person, I mean in detail. But generally, if we're all in the same realm, meaning if we're all humans, as opposed to bugs, you know, as opposed to the animal realm of the five realms of existence, we all see this Gomba as a Gomba, generally speaking. So in that way, we're all synthesizing it in the same manner. But an insect would not at all synthesize this same data as a Gomba, because they're in a different realm. And then you get this beautiful thing in scripture about, you know, there's a bar called the Samsara Bar, and there's a table there, and the bartender, the waitress walks up and says, "What do you have?" You know, and they all say, "Something to drink." And around the table, you got three people sitting. One is a preta, one is a hungry ghost, one is a human being, and one is a worldly deity, a pleasure being, who's in one of the temporary pleasure paradises, you know, not an enlightened being. And they all say, "We'll have something to drink." So the waitress says, "I'm sorry, we only have one glass." And she puts a glass on the table of some liquid. Okay? And it's a very, very delicate debate. But at that moment, the preta says, "Oh my God, gross. She put a glass of blood and pus on the table, you know. I was hoping something to drink, you know." And the human says, "You know, great, water. She put a glass of water on the table." And the pleasure being looks at it and sees the nectar of the gods and says, "Cool, you know, she bought nectar of the gods. Probably Arizona iced tea, I guess." And the question is, are they all having pramanas or not? Pramana means a correct perception, a valid perception, okay? Are they all having a valid perception or not? And if they are, there must be three different things there. But there's not. So, and then you get into this huge debate. The bottom line is, there is something in the glass called liquid. And if you live in a different realm, you'll perceive it in a different way. Now, is it water that a preta is perceiving as blood? Is that a correct way to state it? Not at all. It's liquid that a preta is perceiving as blood. Okay? At that one level, there's no right answer. Okay? It's neither of the three, and it's all three. What if you go down to the next level and check the liquidness of it? You know, is that a projection? Well, there are pretas who would sit in the room and wouldn't see anything in the glass. And it's a very famous example. They see from a distance Boulder Creek, King's Creek, and they say, "Finally, something to drink." And they run, you know. And they get out to the edge and they look down and the water's gone, you know. So what's happening there? What is the data self-existent? Is the data called liquid itself self-existent? If it were, it would always have to be in the glass to any being that looked at it. But when certain pretas look at the glass, they don't see anything in there. So that's a big That's a big debate. I forget what you asked. Is that okay? Something like that, yeah. Okay, now, bear with me for one second, because there's some people that weren't here last night, and I'll go real fast over what happened last night. It's not much, just the ultimate event of a person's Zoian lifetime. We went through the five paths. We were shooting for the path of seeing. What happens on the path of seeing? And we were trying to talk not from the point of view of Buddhist philosophy, but from the point of view of actual experience. What actually happens to a person? If you were an American that this happened to, what would be a typical scenario? And first path would be that, you know, maybe your parents died or something and you got renunciation and you went to live in a monastery or something. You know, like you had some very bad event happen. You got renunciation from that event. So you, if you're very fortunate, if you're some kind of really virtuous person already, or not really virtuous person, but if you're very Kyawa Nyamba, if you have good virtue already, if something clicks in you and you say, ah, life isn't the way I thought it was in high school, something's wrong here. You know, how can, actually, say that half your family dies in 1 year or something. You say, something's wrong here. There's a problem here. You know, life ain't what I thought it was. And you go and stay with some Buddhist teacher. And that's renunciation. Supposedly, this person has reached the first path. True renunciation. Truly bothered by and truly hoping to find some reasoning behind these three deaths or something. You know, you go and you study with this person. And you serve that Lama. You're Sovlam, path of accumulation, collecting virtue, serving the Lama, studying, going through the three stages of Tirjungi Sherab, Samjungi Sherab, and Gonjungi Sherab. Listening, which means study. It doesn't have to be book study, it could be verbal study. But anyway, you are learning from a qualified Lama. Secondly, you're contemplating what you learned. And you get a kind of wisdom from that, and then that turns into Gomchen Vishara, which is meditational wisdom. You start meditating more and more. You begin to have realizations intellectually about the nature of emptiness, and simultaneously you are perfecting your ability to meditate. And you are getting up to the point in your meditations where you're able to keep your mind on what's called the first Dhyani level. You're able to keep your mind on a certain level of meditation which is out of this world, in the sense that it's beyond desire realm state of mind. Your body is still sitting in the desire realm. You are able to put your mind into a state of the first something and a specific section of that something. So two things are going on. You're learning to meditate deeply and you're starting to understand emptiness intellectually. That's the second path, Jorlam, path of preparation. During the second path, you go through four increasingly subtle intellectual understandings of emptiness. That takes you up to the day that you're going to... This is your big day. Day of the path of seeing. That takes you up to, I don't know, like June 14th, 1974. Something like that. And you're ready. And you're standing there making a cup of tea. 75. You're making a cup of tea. And you're looking at the cup of tea and you enter the chuchok. Chuchok means ultimate phenomenon, and that is the final moments of the path of preparation. And you're looking at the pot and you suddenly realize that you're not looking at a pot, you're looking at your mental idealization of a pot. You're looking at a mental thing. You're looking at a picture in your mind. Because pot as you picture it could never exist. Because all you can ever see at one time is a piece of the pot. You're only getting data. You're getting disparate pieces of data. White flash, silver corner, black rod sticking out the side. That's all you ever see. You never see, for example, the back of the pot. But in your mind's eye, there's this perfect pot. That is a mental synthesis of all the parts into a nice mental thing that you then think of as pot. So there's really three steps. You're picking up data, which is colors and shapes. It's not pot yet. you're picking up data, you're synthesizing it into a nice mental picture, and then you're thinking of it as pot. That's called labeling or imputing or whatever you want to call it, but you're thinking of it as pot. And you're mistaking the mental image for something outside of yourself standing on the stove. You're mistaking that mental image for a thing called pot, and you're assuming that pot exists out there on the stove, independent of your projections. By the way, that's gaksha. A pot that could exist that way, which, by the way, doesn't exist at all and never did, is the gaksha. And that's something you have to study. That's what we deny. That's the object we deny the existence of. A pot which could exist standing there on the stove, independent of you synthesizing it and thinking of it as pot. Why? Well, you let a bug walk up there and see if he synthesizes pot. You know, he's synthesizing life-threatening blob. You know, if I come closer, I burn. Better run under the stove. You know, if the pot were self-existently, externally, from its own side, independently, without your projections, existing there, the roach on the stove could have a nice cup of tea. Because for him, it would also be a pleasant boiling pot which you're about to make into tea. But it's not. So it's not. Okay, so so anyway, you realize, you catch yourself. For the first time ever, you catch yourself. You have just understood what we call deceptive reality, what is normally translated as relative truth. You have just understood for the first time the true meaning of dependent origination. Okay? Is that the perception of emptiness? No. Dependent origination is a positive object. It's the way things are. Emptiness is the way they ain't. It's always negative. And that's a big mistake made by many Buddhist schools around the world. Okay? All emptiness is the way things are not. Dependent origination is the way things are. Okay. So you finally, for the first time, catch yourself doing it. You finish making the tea, you take it up to your lama, you go to the temple to do your meditations, you sit down in proper posture, you go into the first sumpten level. Your body is still in the desire realm, your mind is in a higher state of concentration, totally withdrawn from the senses, consciousnesses, and you go into the direct perception of emptiness. And then we talked about that particular moment being like chula chushapa, meaning what? Sorry, little mind. Less samsaric than it was a few seconds before, but still samsaric, okay? It's a mind. It's a relative truth object. It's a dependent, you know, it's a deceptive reality, kunja dhamma. So you cannot be aware of yourself seeing emptiness while you're seeing emptiness. Because yourself is not emptiness. Because yourself is not negative, for example. It's not an absence of something. Then you, maybe 15, 20 minutes, you come down out of it. You have the, maybe your first perception is the sensation of coming down out of that concentration level. And then you start to, all these realizations start to pop in your mind, like popcorn. And those are called the Four Noble Truths. That is the Four Noble Truths. And we talked about how noble is a mistranslation of the word pakpa, which means arya. And they're called arya truths because only people who have just seen emptiness see them. And you directly perceive the truth of four different groups of things. And that experience goes on for the whole day until the time you go to sleep. And we summarize them here under the various truths that they represent. Okay. I suggest we take a break. And then after that you come back and bring up any questions you have, especially about that last part, okay, that last presentation, okay? One question first.
What exactly does the path of seeing end and the path of situations begin?
That's a good question. I think you could say that. Jetal Vyeshi ends, I would say it ends that day.
So,
now whether the night is in the Tonglam or in the Gomlam, I don't know. But the point is that the perception of the Four Noble Truths has ended. Jetop Yeshe has ended. You know, the popcorn realizations in the aftermath of seeing emptiness directly. At the time when those end, then you're out of the path of seeing and you're into the path of habituation. Which one?
The habituation.
Gomlam. Okay, Gomlam. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. When you are getting dependent origination for the first time, do you know then that you're going to...
No.
You just sort of... That
that's all you understand at that moment, and you have no, you don't know what's going to happen a half hour later or something. What's that? She just went what? Well, hopefully you might remember, but I mean, if you haven't had it described directly to you, you wouldn't know that. I think in the aftermath, you would understand that you had just reached Chichol.
Chichol?
No. Nothing like the two sensations that I mentioned, which were in the Jetobyashi, which were the physical sensation of descending from that meditation, and then the physical sensation of love going out from your heart as you have the experience of bodhicitta as an arya. Okay, like that. Take a break and we'll start after that. If you have powder for my hand. Okay. Yeah. Okay. We'll talk about it. Okay. I promised Clint. You gotta remind me to call Sarah May tonight. Okay. Definitely. He had one. He was halfway through a question.
I don't know the last two. The draft theory of Jinsi, the one that's found in Rally, Indian Rally, the both one, the first one is the mental image based on hearing the label.
Or having heard a description of the thing but never having experienced it directly. Like someone's, well, I mean, maybe in a past life, but yeah, or that you would be able to pull up. How's
what,
that?
What if you have to?
Then you can't have a drachi about it.
Then it's a
Jinsi? Yeah.
So if you hear the sound of birds, you never heard before, and you develop a picture of it? Is that a
Jinsi?
That's a Jinsi?
You're trying to catch me. This is a very difficult debate thing. Dai in a dachi in my kevi. Not every dai is a dachi, okay? He's saying, in Tibet you say da da chi and a dachi in my kevi. If something is a da, is a sound and a chi, is it always a dachi? No. Okay. Nice try.
You're using visual perception.
No, I'm always using visual, but it doesn't have to be visual.
But what if you hear something, but like you develop a new visual image?
How would that?
Like you hear a bird sound.
And you see a bird in your mind's eye? You hear the sound and you see a bird in your mind's eye. That is an object, not. That's a jipak tema. That's a logical perception. That's an assumption, actually, and that's a different thing. That object is imagination. That's an imagined bird. You get a drachi first, even to recognize it as a sound. A dinchi, sorry, of a da. You get a dinchi of a da, and then you go through a logical process where you say, well, what makes this sound is that kind of bird. And then your mind synthesizes on mental colors and shapes, on imagined colors and shapes, synthesizes a bird and names it bird and says that bird must be over there.
And then mm-hmm. Isn't it
synthesizing like
the
color? Well, it is. Is it? Yeah. It is different because that's a dinchi. Oh, if you've never seen that bird before, well, I don't know how you'd know it with that particular bird. Oh, you mean that particular bird? No, I'm talking about... That's a big debate in Dharmakirti. It's a huge debate in the Pramanavartika, in the second chapter. And we debate it in the winter debate for months. But generally, you are having a dunchi of that species of bird. Okay, it's not that you necessarily that you've seen that particular bird before. Okay. If you said Sam the robin, you know. No, they didn't have to be a Dunji of Sam the Robin that you saw before, or a Dachi of Sam the Robin that someone described to you that must be, that's living around Vajrapani but you haven't seen yet. Okay.
And what about Dachi and Rikshi?
What's the difference? Or that's an easy question, okay. It's like when you're doing your Geshe exam, you're praying for easy questions, you know. Sokchi is the collection of parts of a physical object. Mm-hmm. Like a collection of parts of the car. Dunji is the mental idealization. I'm sorry, did you say Rikshi? Yeah, Rikshi is car for Chevrolet. Rangisawa Dhamma Yagadang. It's the definition is something like, it's a general category which has many members. It's a set which has many subsets. Think of it as set and subset. That's Rikshi. Rikshi is set. If you get much more subtle into it, and if you go home and think about Rikshi for like 3 days straight and meditate on it, you will come up with the concept of quality and characteristic. Car is a quality. Chevrolet is characteristic of, is not a, but is characteristic of that quality. It's a really delicate distinction. And you have to really meditate on Chichen Da to get to that distinction. And that's very close to perceiving deceptive reality. That's very close to perceiving dependent origination.
The connection I'm not getting is for Chichen
Da. Yeah, yeah. I don't think I tied it up yesterday exactly. You are seeing, when you're looking at the pot and you realize that you're not seeing a pot out on the stove, but you're seeing your mental idealization of a pot based on an imputation, based on a bunch of colors and shapes that suggest pot, that idealization is Dunji. I guess I never told you that last night. Sorry. Yeah, I never did tie that up. That's a Dunji. Oh, okay. You're actually only seeing the Dunji. All you ever see is the Dunji. And you name that pot. You identify it as pot. Okay. You're living in a world of Dunji that you're mistaking for external objects. That wouldn't be so bad if it wasn't the case that if those things really did exist as external objects, they could never change. And that wouldn't be so bad except that they could never change to a non-samsaric object. And that wouldn't be so bad unless you wanted to get to paradise. Okay. But if you did want to get to paradise, it'd be a disaster if things were self-existent. Because then all these samsaric objects would always be samsaric because they exist external of your changes. And you couldn't change them. And you'd be stuck here forever. Seriously, that's the whole idea, and that's the whole point. That's why it would be such a disaster if everything were self-existent. And we're going to get into that. That's the whole point of the Diamond Cutter Sutra. What's the point of talking about emptiness if it doesn't relate to your getting to paradise? Okay. Go ahead, sorry. I'm sorry. Okay. She was... Yeah.
Questions about something happens in this tradition.
All right.
And the first one is, so we see emptiness directly through the first
time. That's Pongam, Papasthene.
Right. Okay, yeah. So after that happens, then you have approximately 7 lifetimes left before you get full enlightenment.
Yeah.
And then you said...
Typically. It could be, somebody asked me today, isn't it true that the Buddha was like 76,000 countless eons? I said, yes. But typical is 7 lifetimes.
So frequently, do you see emptiness directly during the passage of situation? Like you said that you can see it before it. I mean, why can't you see it every time you sit down to meditate from that point on?
Yeah. I'll say two things. One is it doesn't happen very frequently or maybe never happens after that. In the scriptures, it says it happens. It doesn't say how often. Okay. It describes a Nyamshag Yeshi and a Jetob Yeshi for Gomlan, which means there must be it describes a direct perception of emptiness during the Gomlam. Mm-hmm. And it describes a Jetob Yeshi during the Gomlam, you know, periods of aftermath realization. This is Abhidhamma.
Mm-hmm.
But I have not personally seen a scripture that tells you how often it happens. Mm-hmm. And And it doesn't happen. I don't.
It's just like if you're
I know. I of course I know what you mean.
Yeah.
Can't answer that. Well, it's a reasonable question. Now, I can just tell you it doesn't happen. Now, why it doesn't happen? Well, I know that the big deal of the Four Noble Truths, which is all these things, happens only Jetop Yashir Tongam, you know, and that happens at that time. And perhaps the point is that, the working out of your mental friction, using your knowledge of emptiness. By the way, now I can tell you the real definition of nirvana, and I'm not getting off the subject, so if I do, bring me back. This is one way to get out of a thing in a debate, though. Let me tell you about nirvana. Nyendit malupa pambe sosatanga, okay? Nyendit malupa pambe sosatanga. Nyendit means obstacles which are caused by mental affliction. Malupa means in their entirety. Pangbe means eliminating. And then the punchline, sosatango. Sosatango. The ngok in sosatango means cessation of your mental affliction.
Mm-hmm.
The soso tak means realizing one by one, a one by one realization. So what that whole sentence means is, the definition of nirvana is ending your mental afflictions permanently because you have individually realized. And then they explain that individually realized means these dudes up here on the board. Okay. Due to your direct perception of these dudes up here, you are then able, during the path of gom, during the path of habituation, to end your mental afflictions. The day you do, you step off of path number 4 onto miloblam, path number 5, which is nirvana. What I'm suggesting is that during gomlam, what's paramount is your intellectual application of what you saw, sosotango. It's just it's just because I haven't seen any other explanation than that. How to say? It's what happened.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So during, because I've also heard that during the first 7 boomings, until you get to the 8th one, you can kind of slip back.
Slip back in this sense.
Beyond the first
booming
then?
No, impossible.
So yeah. You just can, like, what is that about?
Booming number 8, at booming number 8, Mahayana track.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, on the lower two tracks, the lower two Hinayana tracks, the day you end your mental affliction and the day you reach Nirvana is the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
On Bodhisattva track, when you reach booming number 8, Bodhisattva level number 8, which happens during which path of the 5 paths? Gomlam, yeah. Happens during path of habituation. At that point, you can't have certain kinds of grasping to self-existence anymore. They just stop. They stop completely. And you can't go back from there. And that is nirvana in the Mahayana.
But how can you even go back?
From those other... There's a subject, there's a book, textbook called Genden Nisha, which is the 20... What do you call it? It's like a word and I always forget it. Combinations or permutations. 20 permutations of the 5 paths.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a flow chart. You know, like, you could go halfway down the Hinayana path, see emptiness, skip up to Mahayana. Would you have to see emptiness again? You know, could you skip from Arhat? Could you go directly to Tonglam and path number 3 in Mahayana? Would you have to start over again at Bodhicitta? And, you know, what other... And could you drop? Could you revert? And it's a long subject. It's a whole textbook about that. And we were looking at it today. But, you know, it's a long story. But basically, I don't believe you can slip back from those boomies because they are to have achieved the extraordinary ability to perform that perfection. And I don't think you would slip back from that, although I'm not... I'd have to check the book. Clinton, let's put that on the list, okay? What was your other question?
That was it.
Okay. Yeah, eighth bhumi is important because at that bhumi you overcome certain tendencies to see things as self-existence, and that is nirvana for a Mahayana, for a bodhisattva type person. Yeah. Yeah.
Can I clarify something you said about the very beginning of practice?
Okay.
Did you say that when you enter into the state of mental absorption, then meditation?
Or does it happen simultaneous? You mean like that? Yeah, I would say that first you get into that meditation and you haven't yet got as your object emptiness. And then, you know, maybe in a minute or 5 minutes or 3 minutes, you start to have this as your object of meditation. Emptiness.
And then in that state of absorption, then did you say that is that the truth or not to
emptiness? Once emptiness becomes the object. Yeah.
Okay. Before that.
Yeah, no.
Sensory objects are appearing to mind?
No, can't.
But
mental
objects are not appearing. But,
can't.
Deceptive appearances
can yeah.
The mental function.
Yeah, for example, different thoughts about the meditation's going pretty well, I'm not hearing anything, I'm not seeing anything, you know, like that. Self-awareness could still be happening at that point.
I see. But I'm wondering, is that the point where you would have to bring back to your mind the experience you just had with the thought?
Oh, no, you don't. You don't consciously bring it back.
And how do you meditate on emptiness if you don't bring it back?
I think the karma ripens. You know, the sum, you know, it's not doesn't happen like that. It's not necessary to do that. I guess it's a momentum of the events leading up to that. But you don't consciously, I mean, it's not necessarily true that you would consciously at that point bring your mind on the pot that you just saw. Okay.
And yet you can focus on everything.
Well, it comes to you. Yeah.
It's almost sounding that emptiness suddenly becomes self-existent.
No. I was afraid someone was going to ask. Is emptiness at that moment a projection?
Yeah.
Well, how could it exist? Is emptiness itself dependently originating? If it exists, it has to be dependently originating. So therefore, according to all the theory that I propose, you have to be perceiving parts of emptiness, and then you have to be projecting onto those parts, and like that. You have to be doing that during that moment. Something to think about. What I mean is that no, the perception of emptiness is a result of momentum. Emptiness is a result of nothing. It's not caused.
What could give the momentum?
All those things I mentioned. The achievement. There's a big debate, you know, there's a big distinction between emptiness and the achievement of the perception, direct perception of emptiness. The achievement of the direct perception of emptiness is caused by the momentum of what you've just been through. You know, renunciation, studying hard, serving your lama, and seeing the truth of dependent origination, and then going into that meditation. And what I'm saying is that without necessarily bringing to mind exactly the event of the pot that you just went through, the momentum of all those events and your virtue caused the achievement of the direct perception of emptiness. You can't say it causes emptiness because emptiness doesn't have a cause.
What about the likeness that would cause the result?
In what sense?
In the sense that giving, there's not a likeness between giving and that perception of emptiness. There's not a likeness between taking the mama and perception of emptiness. So these causes are not like the result.
That's a good point. You have to distinguish between what we call Nirlingi Gyu and Hanjik Chaitanya, okay? Nirlingi Gyu is the thing which turns into the thing. It's the material which turns into the result. So like with a ceramic pot, it's the clay. With a sprout of corn, it's the corn seed. With the mind at 8:40 8:37, it's the mind, it's your mind at 8:36 that actually flops over, we say, flops over into the new thing, which provides the main material for the new result. And that has to be similar, stuff. Stuff has to be similar. There has to be a likeness between a corn seed and a corn sprout. There has to be likeness between clay and a ceramic pot. There has to be likeness between your mind at 8:36 and your mind at 8:37. Plantic chicken means contributing factors. And in the case of the sprout, it's fertilizer, earth, water, and sunlight, and air. And in the case of the ceramic pot, it's the potter and the wheel, and the availability of clay and stuff like that. In the case of the direct perception of emptiness, the plantic chicken are all those virtues. Serving your lama, you know, doing good things, building him a house, you know, taking care of his teeth, taking care of his eyes, serving him when he's sick, cooking for him for years, something like that. Those are the authentic chicken. Those are the contributing factors. The thing that flops over into the direct perception of emptiness is the Tujungi Sherab, Samjungi Sherab, and Gomjungi Sherab. The study, the understanding of emptiness that was created by your study, the understanding of emptiness that was created by your contemplation, and the understanding of emptiness that was created by meditating on your contemplation in an intellectual way, and that all flops over into the direct perception of emptiness. That's the mind states that became the wisdom which perceives emptiness directly. So you're talking about contributing factors and main material that becomes that. You know. Okay. Excuse me, one more thing. And without those plantic chickens, forget it. You know, you can have all the corn seeds in the world, but if there's no water, you can sit there and pray all day long. And that's what happens to people. That's what happens to American Buddhist practitioners. You know, I'll study emptiness for years from a book, but I don't have the contributing factors of guru yoga and you know, normal old virtues, you know, not lying, not stealing, taking care of other people's lives, you know, not committing sexual misconduct. And it's not enough just to study. You have to have, you could have real neat corn seeds, and if you don't have all the other stuff, forget it. It won't work. And people get frustrated. They say, I've been studying Madhyamika. I've been meditating. I don't understand what's going on. I'm not sure if it's correct. Nothing's happening. And you got to look at the contributing factors. And those are necessary contributing factors. They're like water and soil. Okay. Yeah. That's chichedā, the thing about the quality and characteristic. Quality and characteristic. There's something about, listen, okay? There's something about thinking about that which is very important. Car and Chevrolet. Quality and characteristic. There's a big clue there. There's big ammunition there. There's something very important there. It is very, very jetumba. Chatumba is very, very good fertilizer for that moment of seeing what the pot really was. Somehow, the knowledge of car and Chevrolet, quality and characteristic, studied sincerely, becomes the nirlengi gyu, the stuff that flops over into chuchol, the final moment when you understand dependent origination, that you understand that you're watching a mental image. Somehow, all of that study of chichedā is extremely important for that to happen. They call Dura, which is a baby logic book, you know, Dura, they call it the key to Madhyamika. They call it the key to understanding emptiness. These are elementary topics, mostly concerning perception, that come from Dharmakirti's logic book. So really, I mean, a lot of Tsongkhapa students used to say the kindest thing he ever did for me was to teach me Buddhist logic. And you wouldn't think that Buddhist logic would have much to do with seeing emptiness. But there's Buddhist logic and perceptual theory are intimately related. And once you study how you see things, it gives you a lot of big push. That's why Dharmakirti spent his life on it. It gives you a big push into understanding chichedā. And if you get that right, you're going to see dependent origination quickly, immediately. Yeah?
Could you give some more examples? Because
Any sentence, sub-sentence. I'll give you the classic one. It's called Shidduki Namshak. Say Shidduki Namshak. Shidduki Namshak. A two-page summary of all existing objects. You start with existence. It's up here. Okay. And then two subsets coming off. And that's changing things and unchanging things. Mistranslated as permanent and impermanent. Okay. Changing things and unchanging things. Why do I say mistranslated? Which side is emptiness on? No. It's unchanging. Is it permanent? Not at all. The day I destroy this blackboard, whiteboard, its emptiness goes out of existence. Did it change? No. Its quality was always the same. It was never more or less pure emptiness. But if I destroy the basis of it, it can't exist anymore. There's no more emptiness of the whiteboard because there ain't no more whiteboard. So emptiness is not permanent, but it is unchanging. And that's a very bad translation. It screws up a lot of people. Okay, so there's a word in Tibetan called Thakpa and Nitakpa. Nitya and Anitya, I don't know what it is. But anyway, Nitya. Anyway, and it's been translated throughout the history of Buddhism as in the West as permanent and impermanent. And in the case of this philosophy, not in the case of, for example, the impermanence of death in Alam Rim, it cannot be translated as permanent or impermanent. Because blackboard, the emptiness of blackboard is not permanent, but it is tattva. Because it's unchanging. Its quality is unchanging. So anyway, changing and unchanging. You go over to the... So there you've got one chi and two chedan. Two characteristics and one quality. Okay, being an existing thing is characteristic of all unchanging things. Being an existing thing is also characteristic of all changing things. You want some more? Go over to changing things. They split into three. Okay, say sup, shepa, demandishi. Physical changing things, mental changing things, and changing things which are neither mental nor physical. And an example of that is J is not J's body. J is not J's mind. But J is changing. J is a concept. It's a changing thing which is neither mental nor physical. J. Okay. There's an example. Okay, those are three. Want to go further? Nah. Mind, you could go into main mind and mental function. Main, basic awareness. And then the particular mental functions. Anger, jealousy, concentration, focus, feeling, sensation. And then you can keep going like... But every time you split it, all of the subsets are chedaks of the chi. The minute you split it, the chedak becomes a chi for something below it. So chi and chedak are not contradictory. You can be a chi and a chedak at the same time. Okay. Depends on which way you're looking at it. As the mother of a subset, or as the subset of another mother. Okay. Yeah.
About the physical and the mental, and yeah, about perceptions, and you know how like eye, ear, nose, you know, and then mind is a separate one. And it seems to me, the way I've understood you, you're saying that the eye ones aren't physical, but you just said it divided into physical and mental. I thought you said that if it's the eye consciousness, it's consciousness, so therefore it's mental. Mm-hmm. But then sometimes I know they say that like eye, ear, the sense consciousness is not physical. So
you have to distinguish between the eye faculty and the consciousness of your, and the visual consciousness. Okay, the visual consciousness, awareness of red and square, right. Awareness of red and square is something mental. Red and square is physical. The awareness of red and square depends on a small group of cells at the back of the eyeball called Niki Wangbo, the power of the eye, the faculty of the eye, and that is physical matter. Okay, like that. This is the first chapter of the Abhidhamma. Long story. Eye faculty is physical, The I consciousness is mental.
I understand that during the path of habituation, after the experience of emptiness that you're using...
First direct experience of emptiness.
I guess it's correct that you're using the merit of that direct experience of emptiness to remove the klesha during the path of habituation.
We're going to talk about that tomorrow. Okay? We're going to talk about... We've already touched on it briefly, but we're going to talk about what's that sotatangok stuff. How does understanding these events help you to remove your mental afflictions permanently? And why is it true that if you don't perceive these events, sotatangok, you can never remove your mental afflictions permanently? Okay. Yeah.
So.
No, it's not just the karma. Ultimately everything is, but I mean, it's understanding these and applying it to everyday situations in your life that is the bread and butter of the path of habituation.
I'm trying to get to another question now.
Okay.
If I remember correctly, the final klesha is that propensity, that tendency to project a self-existent nature.
Yeah, the inherent tendency.
The event that we're perceiving.
Yeah, the inherent tendency to think it comes from its own side.
Mm-hmm. So once that's removed, then the individual enters nirvana.
Yeah, that is nirvana. The removing and the entering are the same thing. Yeah.
So once an individual is in the state of nirvana, is dependent origination and emptiness simultaneously perceived?
Good question. By the way, they are still living in the world of relative truth. They are still, you know, they can still see red and colors, and they just don't get mad anymore. Or they don't get jealous anymore. They're incapable of it. But they're still perceiving those objects. They just don't think they're self-existent anymore. Only a Buddha can simultaneously focus on emptiness and relative truth at the same time. Only a Buddha can simultaneously focus on emptiness, on ultimate reality, and deceptive reality at the same time.
I wonder, the removal of that final klesha, is it sometimes compared in intensity and significance to that initial experience of emptiness?
I don't think it's anything like the initial thing, but of course it's a big threshold. It's like, I'd say, second most important threshold, maybe. I don't know. But it's definitely a big event. What happens then is that you no longer believe in self-existence and things no longer seem to be self-existent. And from that point back to the point of seeing emptiness directly, things, you know they're not self-existent, but they look self-existent. Okay? And after the eighth Bodhisattva Bhumi, if you're on a Bodhisattva chat, and you get rid of the inherent tendency to see things that way that even bugs and amoebas have, things no longer look self-existent. Is that Buddhahood? No. You still have some, there are still some activities that you undertake in order to reach omniscience. In order to, I have to think they're pretty close. I can't say from experience. But what I mean is, ending, when you get to the point where things stop looking self-existent, between that point and the point at which you can perceive every object in the universe, past, present, and future, at the same moment, there's a little time between there. No, really, that's what the other boomings are for. You know. Okay. Yeah.
Huh?
Sure. Anything you want.
I wasn't able to listen fast enough to what was going on yesterday about that direct sensation of bodhicitta if you're on the bodhisattva path.
Right.
And I just wanted to catch that more
specifically. Okay.
And like, what if you've just been giving bodhicitta kind of lip service? It's not that you kind of think of yourself as a hanging out, but
yeah, right. there's a thing called Timke Chima. Chima means the example my Lama always used to give. We used to travel a lot to Washington, D.C. We'd always stop in the same restaurant. The same waitresses would say, "Hi, how are you?" And he used to joke about them. And they would bring out this fake...